has been pre-recorded. Please enjoy this special presentation.
Truly Valued is a nonprofit serving Sarasota, Manatee, and DeSoto counties through youth leadership, mentoring, family support, and restorative justice programs. Their work includes youth development through IM Academy, mentoring and prevention through youth empowerment services, family strengthening through the Nurturing Families program, and restorative justice through Rise Academy. These programs support youth, families, and justice-involved individuals in building life skills, strengthening relationships, and creating positive paths forward in their community. For more information about Truly Valued and its programs, visit trulyvalued.org.
Hey there, Hoyle here. My radio show, Hoyle's House, I play blues, both traditional and contemporary, as well as alternative rock. It's an eclectic mix of music that I work hard to curate for you, our listeners. You can listen live at 96.5 or stream live at WSLR.org or listen on our app. So I hope that you will tune in.
WSLR Fogartyville is a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and provides peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice.
That's right. You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. You can find us on the web at WSLR.org. The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
This is the Progressive Paige Turner. I'm Marianne Barisonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them.
Book, Love in an Effed Up World, Dean Spade writes, quote, "If we are to collaborate to survive the disasters shaping our lives and to destroy systems of domination, we need to root out the programming that dominant culture has implanted in us." As a transgender activist, writer, and associate professor of law, he's been fighting that programming for over 20 years. Dean, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So how do mainstream ideas about sex and romance perpetuate systems of dominance? And how do we get out from under their control? We'll start with a small question.
Yeah, nothing too big. Our societies are organized through a very particular family form and gender norms that include a whole story about how people are supposed to connect, what kinds of sex are good and bad, what is supposed to make you happy. And there's a formula about marriage and children, and that setup is like actually incredibly pivotal to colonization, capitalism, racism, white supremacy. Like it's a big deal, and it was a huge part of the creation of the lives most people on Earth live now, that colonizing powers took very core ideas about gender, sexuality, and family and forced them on populations all over the world. So it's no small thing structurally. And then in our day-to-day lives, we really take this stuff in. We identify with it. A lot of times things that feel like there are feelings and desires and wants are actually cultural scripts that we inherited, that we've taken in by every love song, every movie, every story, our whole lives, sometimes things through our religions, through our educational system. And one of the things that I'm trying to work out in this book is, how do we get to a place where we can say, is that really what I want? Or is that something I was told to want or told breeds happiness or brings fulfillment? And how can I get out of a coercive norm and into asking myself a more profound question about what actually satisfies, what kinds of connection I need to be happy and not isolated? And one of the premises of the book is that what I call the romance myth, the kind of idea that like your life will be happy if you find a certain kind of partner and have a certain kind of relationship and go through a certain set of steps together that are considered the normal steps of increasing connection and formalization of your relationship. That idea that thing will make you happy and that that's what you should want. And if you don't have that, your life isn't good and you're less valuable, and that you should pressure other people into it. That idea is really toxic and moves us away from finding out what actually we want in our sexual relationships and our friendships. It also is very isolating. A lot of people end up stuck in relationships where they don't have enough support outside of that one relationship. There's so much evidence of this. A lot of people end up ditching friends, ditching things they care about in pursuit solely of trying to get and keep a romantic partner. And as we know, most of those relationships don't actually last. So people feel like these profound levels of disappointment and resentment. People often try to control their loved ones and spouses and partners to try to make the thing like it's supposed to be on TV. There's a lot of suffering, a lot of behavior outside our values, a lot of community conflict and loss of friend circles and family connections because of these expectations that are often unexamined.
When you were talking about how colonization and systems of dominance shape who we are, how are our identities the result of repeated practice?
That's what I'm trying to get at in this book. I spent my life trying to change these big systems. And I'm interested in the place where the big systems are also replicated inside us. Gender is such an obvious example. From a very early age, from birth, you're assigned a gender, and then you're required to repeat it. You get in trouble if you don't do the norm. It happens from before you even are aware or have memory. There's studies about how children that are identified as boys are touched less and dressed in certain colors and we're told to like certain things. And that if you break those rules, there's varying degrees of punishment and shame. And there's all kinds of other norms that go with that. It's intertwined with racial norms, with norms about heterosexuality and so many other things. And that stuff lives in us. And for me, I'm part of feminist and anti-racist movements that believe that we could seek liberation from that and be like, oh, wait, what do we actually want to do together? And what's it like when we have a world where we don't punish people who fall outside these completely made up bananas norms that also like change over time and change depending on where you live and what cultural group you're part of? They're just made up. And so that basic idea for me is something a lot of people are familiar with from feminism and anti-racism. But I think a lot of us don't then ask the same questions about sex and romance and friendship. What did I learn about this? And do I really want the stuff that I think I want? Or was I just told that I have to desperately want that and that's what will make me happy? And am I pushing that agenda on others? What would it be like for us to seek out a more consensual connection with people we care about and to value each other more holistically instead of just if you can give me this thing that I think is the most important thing because I was told it is.
These gender roles that we internalize and our relationship in a romantic situation, these have changed over time. Can you go over a little bit about how they've changed over time?
The idea of what constitutes femininity or masculinity changes in different subcultures. It changes. It certainly changes over time, right? Like, obviously, we've had hundreds of years of feminist movements that have tried to move away from an idea that women are the property of men, that certain professions should be closed to women, that women can't be educated in particular ways. We've had really complicated social movements against colonialism and racism that have questioned the imposition of European norms. In North America, where I live, European settlers came and told the indigenous people that the way they did sexuality, family, and social connection was wrong and backwards. And so there's an enforced set of norms through the burning of people's longhouses, through forcing indigenous children to go to boarding schools, and enforcing European binary gender norms. And this has been what Europeans have done through colonization all over the world. And also justifying the intervention and the colonization by saying, we have to fix these people. They're so backward. They do their gender wrong. They treat their women wrong, or their sex is unchristian or whatever it is. These are still the rationales that are used for colonization war around the world. It's so pivotal, this idea of gender norms, and that whatever society you're in, those gender norms you're told are natural. But of course, they change all the time and they change wherever you go. And you can see differences between people in different subcultures, even in the city you live in, who have different ideas about what a boy or a girl should or shouldn't do, or have different rules around dress or hairstyles of what seems, you know, normal and essential. And when we're enforcing them on each other and on ourselves, we're quite rigid about it. But actually, these things are quite flexible. You know, even just who can have long hair changes historically over not that many decades. I think it's just a useful thing to know that they're made up and that they're made through repeated practice and through enforcement between each other. And to ask, like, what would it be like for me to stop enforcing those on others and myself? and to imagine a more liberated engagement. I think one place we see this a lot these days is that polyamory is a lot more popular, and non-monogamy. There's a lot more conversation among young people, especially, but people of all ages, and a lot more literature about whether or not monogamy is the only legitimate way to have a relationship. And there was similar conversations about that in the 1960s and 70s during what people called the sexual revolution. And there was a drastic change in how typical it was for people to live together unmarried. These norms do change with time. And the question is, can we become more conscious of that? And might we actually intentionally try to shake off some of the rigidity that limits our lives? What's wild to me is that it arises in us like it's, you know, Marianne, we have to be monogamous because I love you and it's the only way I'll know a relationship is real. And it's like, is that coming from me? Or is that coming from the 75 rom-coms I watched in adolescence? What would it be like to really try to find out what kinds of more liberated norms do we want to seek where there's more consent?
Our ideas about who we are and how we should be with each other is really shaped by a lot of the larger culture, like the emphasis on materialism. How does materialism shape our relationships and our well-being?
It's really hard. We live in racial capitalism, and the story is you'll be happy if you can own a home, and if you had more money, you'd be happy. And people have immense striving to try to have more money and blame their pain and suffering on that someone has more than them. And certainly, true poverty really does make your life very hard and shorten your life. But for people who are not in extreme poverty, the quest for money, like all the studies about this show, doesn't actually make people happier. And you see this by watching TV, that rich people are miserable and have really messed up lives often.
Elon Musk is a prime example.
So many examples, right? So all the billionaires who are trying to destroy all of our lives. When I was writing this book, I was reading research about how many, many, many people, the majority of people, believe that they will someday be millionaires. You know, even though, of course, there's actually very little economic mobility in U.S. society. Like, most people are going to not move upward, and also wealth is concentrating, and so more people are going to be poorer than ever as we keep concentrating more and more wealth with these billionaires. So this idea, this identifying with those above us, striving, being willing to climb any ladder and step on anyone to get there, and not really being in touch with the intrinsic things that make me happy and satisfied, orienting towards when I get that car, when I get that house, when I get that certain kind of body, when I get that certain kind of relationship, then I'll be happy, as opposed to the things that studies show actually make people happy, like doing things because they're pleasurable, helping others, having a meaningful life, being connected to purpose. But what the striving activities, the working endlessly, the shopping, the being online, the trying to get status, those things actually take us away from things that are likely to give us more emotional satisfaction. And part of what we can see is we're the most isolated people in the history of the world. People in the U.S. more likely to live alone, have less friendship connections, have less social safety net with one another, and report loneliness at shocking rates. And so part of what I'm asking in this book is how we make better relationships, and how do we stick together when things are hard, and how do we recreate social ties that have really been lost for a lot of us? And part of that is shaking loose of the illusion that the thing I want is the social media following or the, you know, fancy house or whatever, when that doesn't actually satisfy people.
And another aspect of it is the disposability culture, the idea that we can just get rid of people willy-nilly, vote the people off the island. But that's really isolating, because instead of doing the emotional work to get along with people, we're just getting rid of them. One of the ideas that you spend a lot of time on in the book is getting good at giving and receiving feedback. Why is that such an important skill?
People in the U.S., we live in the most imprisoning society in the history of the world. There has never been a society that put more people in a cage and had more cops on the streets. And that has a deep impact on our psyches. This is what creates the disposability culture. The idea that if someone makes a mistake, they should be gotten rid of, that we should punish people. We all live in fear that we're going to be caught making a mistake. So there's a kind of rigidity, perfectionism, shame, hiding, and quick to judge. And so people's ties become very thin. We don't repair when there's something that goes wrong. We just bail, or we want to tell everyone in the community how bad this person is and have everyone else hate them too. So in the book, I talk so much about giving and receiving feedback, because we're pretty bad at it. Just saying like, oh yeah, you know, when you don't do the dishes, it's like this for me, or oh, when you're late to hang out, or, you know, just whatever these day-to-day things are, we don't give the feedback. And most of us withhold the feedback And then we either blow up at some point and there's a really big conflict. And by then I've got a whole story about you and how you're not a good friend or whatever. Or we just kind of disappear from the relationship. A lot of people just ghost, especially their friends. And so what I'm trying to talk about in the book is the skill set for moving away from disposability is the skill set of being able to tell somebody when they're impacting you in some way, even though you don't know if they're, how they're going to respond and you're not sure, maybe I'm interpreting it wrong, kind of taking that risk. And then also the skill set of hearing that and being non-defensive, like, wow, Marianne's telling me about the dishes or about what it's like when I'm late or what it was like when I missed your birthday out of an investment in our connection. This is not you trying to get rid of me, even though I may be very scared because we're all kind of like, oh God, I don't want to get in trouble with my friend. You know, we all have this internal fear that comes from living in this carceral culture. But instead to see feedback as a step towards intimacy and connection. When you give someone feedback and they listen to you and say, hey, I'm going to try to work on that, even if they work on it imperfectly, now I'm like, I'm in it with you for life. Like it actually makes such a tight bond. Because it happens to us so rarely in this culture. Most of us only get feedback in a top-down setting, like grades from teachers or our parents are punishing us. We don't really actually get to have a lot of give and receive feedback relationships. And it is so amazing to have someone listen to you and not minimize what you experienced and try to hear your point and say they're going to give it a shot, even if they don't do it perfectly. And so really encouraging people to practice this and to try and to believe in the possibility of repair, which doesn't mean it goes perfectly. You might come to me and I might at first be kind of defensive, but then I try again. We're not good at it because it's so countercultural, but it can be, I think it's what's missing in most groups and most relationships is starting with small stuff and not waiting till it gets huge and saying to each other, hey, we're going to try this, even if it's a little clumsy. It can really glue a relationship, any kind of relationship, when you're working on something together, anything.
Sunshine Community Compost and Community Harvest SRQ have merged to form Sunshine Community Harvest, a unified nonprofit dedicated to cultivating and advancing a resilient local food network that nourishes the community and planet. The two organizations previously worked side by side, advancing community-powered solutions to food waste, soil health, and fresh food access. By joining forces, they hope to scale this impact even further. More information is available at their new website, sunshinecommunityharvest.org. You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest is Dean Spade, and we're talking about his book, Love in an Effed Up World. We live in a culture, and you touch on this in the book, where people are labeled as either good or bad. And then we look for the cops to settle the problem of the evil people. And that means that we don't actually sit down with people and say, okay, well, maybe you messed up, but we need to figure out how to make this work.
Yeah, and we're all imperfect. And we all need chances to find out. Like, right, I also don't know. I so often might be doing something that hurts you that I don't even know I'm doing because we need each other to hear how we land. I may not know that I'm really short when I'm tired, or I may not know that I'm saying things that are sexist or racist because we're all imbibing a bunch of garbage. We're all repeating stuff our parents said or that was said around us at school. We need other people to help us know how we land. And we miss that opportunity when it's just like, oh, well, you were late a couple of times. You don't care about me. I'm jumping to conclusions about it and I'm not even going to try with you anymore. Or I'm so scared to tell you something, or I'm so scared to hear that I'm not perfect that I just defend myself when you try to come to me.
And while we can look at that and say, yeah, people need multiple chances, there are people who have really destructive tendencies. And how do we distinguish between potentially constructive conflict and destructive abuse?
Yeah, I think that there's no certain way to define abuse versus conflict. I think the most useful thing is to ask ourselves, when I go and use a word like abuse, it might mean I'm signaling to myself, wow, I'm really distressed. Or I'm signaling to someone else, I'm really distressed. Or I'm signaling to a friend, hey, I really need your help with this. So sometimes it's just a word we use to indicate that something maybe needs a more serious boundary or this is really not working for me. I don't think we can ever come up with a perfect definition of it. And then I think we also need to hold inside that we might feel very distressed sometimes about very small things. Mostly when I'm upset, I can't tell what size something is, you know, like, and that's really hard to deal with. So another way to look at trying to figure out what size something is having friends I can talk to about it, looking for patterns and knowing whether or not I need to leave a relationship might be like, wow, is there a pattern of trying to state my needs and not getting them? Is there a pattern of somebody dismissing what I'm saying? Is there a pattern of some kind of behavior that I think endangers me? This is why the book has such a strong emphasis on friendship. I really think it's hard to figure this stuff out by ourselves. We really need people who are trustworthy to bounce it off of. And we also need to learn how to be good friends. We need to learn how to, you know, our friend is upset and not just be like, oh yeah, that person is terrible, but instead really listen. Like, yeah, what is the right size response to this? Let me help you think this through. Is this something that requires feedback or should you stop being roommates with that person? Is this something that means that you need to quit that job or is this something where maybe you could advocate for yourself and there's something about that you still need? We need help. A big message in this book is just when we're emotionally activated, we often can't discern what's going on fully. We might really be minimizing our own experience or we might be really emphasizing the other person is so bad. And that's okay to do. All of those feelings are acceptable, but how can I be like, oh, wow, I'm really upset. What's the kind of way to discernment? And a lot of the exercises in the book are about trying to find discernment when I'm upset or trying to support people when they're upset to find discernment so that I don't just act out my most reactive tendencies, which we all have, but that's often when I'm going to do the weird cultural stuff. That's often when I'm going to play out the disposability or the hierarchy or the jealousy or campaigning against other people in my community and telling people not to like them. It's violating someone else's privacy. A lot of times when we do the weird stuff we all do, we were really emotionally activated and we didn't have an awareness that, and we were just kind of like popping off.
And a lot of times we don't even realize how big the reaction is until we get some perspective. But there's that catchphrase, if it's hysterical, it's historical. And that gets back to how our childhoods affect how we relate to other people.
Yeah, I love that phrase because it just reminds me, if I'm, you know, let's say you and I have been in an activist group for 6 months together and or 2 years, and I'm just livid with you and I'm so upset about whatever it is you said or did. What's being sparked in me has something to do with your behavior, perhaps, or our disagreement. But if I'm that upset, we're also revisiting some stuff that happened to me earlier. Maybe in childhood, I felt like not listened to, and I feel like you're not listening to me. Or maybe I felt minimized, or maybe I felt like I had to do everything and no one else was supporting me. Whatever. I'm in some historical feeling. And it's not about therefore saying that nothing's going on between you and me, but can I have a little bit of accountability and responsibility for what I'm bringing to the picture and care for that in myself and have compassion for myself, but have a grain of salt around the fact that if I'm this upset, I might be in an older wound and it might be not totally fair to think that's all about you or all about this group we're in or this relationship we're in. Can that be helpful for finding bright-sized responses to what's hard between me and you?
There's another area that I thought was really interesting, the way you handled it. The difference between codependence and interdependence. Because a lot of times, like, I'll be confused about the codependent thing. Well, aren't we all dependent on each other?
Yeah, I'm glad you picked that out. I'm also just so grateful for your close reading. It's like very much an honor to have someone read a book so closely. Yeah, the term codependency has been critiqued by a lot of feminists and disability justice activists. We are interdependent. I think the term has some use and it's been used a lot in different 12-step programs and stuff. So I'm not ready to totally throw it out, even though I really appreciate the critique and I do believe we're interdependent. I specifically use the term codependency to mean when I'm making you responsible for my feelings, or I'm taking responsibility for your feelings. So either I'm like, Marianne's mad, I must have done something wrong, I shouldn't share my desire for what we have for dinner or for what the group does or whatever. Or I'm like, I'm mad. You made me mad, or you made me sad, or you made me feel abandoned. It's like, actually, Dean, you know, I'm having this feeling and you are another person whose words or actions may stimulate this feeling in me, but it's actually my feeling. You're not making me feel anything. And I can move out of disempowerment and towards, oh, does this mean I got a request for you, or I need some change to some of our relationship, or I haven't told you something that value you're affecting me, or the way that when you say certain things that it lands on me. But that's not the same as you're making me feel something or I'm making you feel something. In codependency, I think a lot of times people are in very long relationships. They believe in this inappropriate responsibility. It could lead to something like, I get jealous when you hang out with your friends, so you stop hanging out with your friends. That's like a really common one in romantic relationships. Or I'm threatened when you say that you want to go to graduate school and move to another place. That freaks me out, so you don't do it because you're trying to protect me from my feelings. Whenever we're trying to take too much responsibility for another person's feelings or give someone else that responsibility, I think that we lose the sense that we can choose in the relationship and it becomes coercive. Not like you're coercing me, but I'm creating, co-creating with you or with myself a coercive container where we're no longer choosing and we're going to end up resenting each other.
One of the things that I really liked about this book is the way that you take personal relationships and public relationships in groups. A lot of our behaviors don't work. We haven't practiced certain skills, and it's in both the private and the public sphere. There's a lot of tools in this book that either individuals or groups can use. One of them is the mad mapping. How does that work?
I learned about mad mapping from a group called the Icarus Project, which later became something called the Fireweed Collective. I recommend people look them up. And that's a group that is all people who have been labeled by the mental health system in some way or identify as mad or as having mental health stuff. And a lot of that group's focus is about self-help and mutual aid around getting through having periods of having strong mental and emotional states. And this tool, mad mapping, is basically where, let's say you know you go to an intense mental or emotional state sometimes. When you're not in it, ideally, you make yourself a map of things that help and don't help in that time. And it could be a map that you just use yourself or that you also share with people in your life who you want support from. So an example is that I give in the book is jealousy. I get jealous romantically when my partners have new partners sometimes. And sometimes it's really unpleasant. And so then it's like, okay, what kind of thoughts go through my head when I'm jealous? What kinds of ideas do I have of things that I'd like to actually, I shouldn't do that. Don't do that. You know, for some people, this isn't one of mine, but some people are like, don't look at the social media of the other person. Or for me, maybe like, don't ask these questions I don't actually want to know the answers to. Or don't listen to these kinds of songs. I'm a college student. During exams, I got to remember to eat. I shouldn't use these substances. Or maybe when you are having a really hard time, you call your really mean aunt, and that's always bad for you. So you're put on your mind map, don't call my aunt. And you can give it to your friends. You can be like, when I'm in this super strong anxiety or super strong depression or when I'm in this jealousy, please ask me these questions. Don't ask me these questions. You know, a lot of people's mad map just says like, don't call the cops on me, things like that. Or please bring me food. Please don't come by unannounced. Do come by unannounced. When I'm in a less activated state, I can see what did and didn't help in the activated state. And then I give myself and maybe my friends instructions for that time. And it's so practical because who knows better what you need during your most difficult states than you. And better than any book about it, better than any therapist or your friends even. And so trying to really harvest that wisdom of what happened the last time I lost it with that thing. For some people, it's a season of the year where a death anniversary comes up, or a season of the year where they get really busy with work, or maybe they're a performer and certain things happen when they have day after day of performances, or certain things happen when people have to take a certain medicine cycle and it makes them have insomnia, whatever. Any strong state where you're like, I lose my stuff in this period.
You must be involved with a lot of activist groups. And do you see them getting better at this and really working on it?
Yeah. One of the main things I've been doing for the last 15 years is supporting so many different groups and so many different individual organizers and activists who are in different groups all over the world with the kinds of group dynamic issues that are honestly such a big threat to our movement. So many groups fall apart over all kinds of conflict. And so I spend a lot of time just helping groups do feedback skills like we talked about before.